the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California education funding coming out of the LA teacher strike. That's what parents and teachers are talking about. Governor Gavin Newsom says he wants to inject cash into K through 12 classrooms, but can California afford it? We'll hear from Assemblyman Phil Ting on whether the state budget has that kind of wiggle room. Plus, we'll tell you what's screening at this week's Sundance Film Festival that you'll be lining up to see later this year. It's all ahead on Take Two.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. In case you're not a big sports fan, this is the start of Super Bowl Hype Week. The Rams are going to be taking on the Patriots this week. And one of the questions I've gotten from some non-sports friends is, when is the last time LA had a Super Bowl or was in a Super Bowl? It's a little bit tricky. Back in 1984, the LA Raiders played in the Super Bowl. They beat Washington. Before that, in 1980, it was the LA Rams. So there, it's a little tough because LA has had a very complicated LA football history. All right, coming up in just a few minutes, we catch up with John Horn, host of KPCC's entertainment and arts program, The Frame.
We have seen most of 33 movies so far, but we're still intact both in mind and in spirit.
The Frame team is on the ground in Park City, Utah, and joins us to talk about this year's notable films at Sundance. First, though, it's been almost a week since the Los Angeles teachers' strike was declared over, but its effects are still being felt across the state. Teachers in Oakland, California are now considering a possible strike next month. It all comes down to money. Most of the conversations leading up to and through the six-day strike in LA have highlighted the need for more education funding in California. Governor Gavin Newsom has pledged to spend more money on K through 12 education, but he can't do much if lawmakers in Sacramento do not get behind him. Now, to get a sense of whether legislators will support that effort, we turn to Assemblymember Phil Ting. He chairs the Assembly Budget Committee. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know it's early still. Your committee is meeting tomorrow for the first time this year, but all eyes are on you guys up there in Sacramento right now. Lawmakers are looking at an education budget proposal of $80.7 billion, touted as a record amount. Assemblyman, what was your immediate reaction to this dollar figure?
Well, the dollar figure is based primarily on a formula, which we've been very supportive in the past. And I think just to set it in context, when I first arrived here in 2012, the education spending was at $47 billion. So we've almost doubled the amount of K through 12 spending over the last 8-9 years. So we've made a huge amount of progress. A lot of that is due to our growing budget, our growing economy. What I've told teachers and, frankly, parents in my district as well as all over the state, we frankly need more revenue in order to spend more money in education.
Now, that $80.7 billion covers a lot, from special ed funding to paying down pension debt. For you, what stands out as the priority?
Well, the priority is making sure that the money's getting to the classrooms. We've been working to try to get more accountability, more transparency, to make sure that the money was actually getting to the classrooms. Mm-hmm. Many of the legislators have championed those efforts, and unfortunately, we've been fought with the previous governor. We're hoping that the next governor, this current governor, is going to be much more receptive to that.
So does that mean pension debt goes down on the list a little bit?
No, it wasn't. Not at all. What we want to make sure is that the money is getting into classrooms. All of these pensions and all of the wages are all bargained by district. And so we want to make sure that they're bargaining correctly, but at the same time that the money is getting into the classroom and actually helping the students they're supposed to help. We changed our funding formula when I first came in here in 2013 so that more money went into districts that had a high number of low-income students, English as a second language students, and foster children. That money, we've delivered on that money 100%. We wanted to make sure that over time that money's actually getting to those kids.
Talking to California Assemblymember Phil Ting. Assemblyman, is it fair to call you fiscally conservative?
You know, I think we're fiscally responsible.
Well, you. I'm talking about you.
I think I'm fiscally responsible.
Fiscally responsible.
Yeah, it's interesting. Coming from San Francisco, no one's really ever called me conservative, but you're the first.
Well, I'm not calling you a conservative. I'm saying fiscally conservative. I'm just wondering, because is it helpful then that many of the government's budget proposals call for one-time costs as opposed to recurring ones?
Well, absolutely, because I don't know if you read the legislative analyst report. They're the ones who do our fiscal analysis for the legislature. They thought going into what may be recessionary years over the next couple of years, that we should have a goal of setting aside $25 billion in reserves, and that really, even with $25 billion in reserves, it would not be responsible to spend more than $3 billion. The way I think of it is our budget has committed to many things over the last couple of years. We've increased spending significantly. Much of it was just to bring back to pre-recessionary levels. But we made those promises to many people, whether it's people on CalWORKs, CalFresh, people on Medi-Cal, very important social programs. We don't want to have to go back to 2008 and have to cut those programs after we just made all this progress. So we need to make sure we're saving money, but also making sure that we are keeping our promises made to all those people that rely on government every day.
And saving money means more one-time cost spending, though, right? That's kind of the thought there.
Well, the thought is making sure that we can keep our promises. It's no different than the promises you keep to your children or your loved ones. We have a responsibility to keep all those promises so that when people come to expect, you know, food stamps or health care, that it's there, that when they need it, it's there. So it would be horrific to, when we had to cut it, they went to go use that health care, they went to go use those food stamps, and they weren't there. So For education, first and foremost, we want to make sure that the money's getting to the kids. The one-time expenditures, the reason it makes sense. So, for example, while it didn't show up on the education ledger, Governor Newsom proposed spending a few billion dollars to pay down the CalSTRS, which is the teachers' pension fund. So that pension payment helps give districts relief who are paying money into their pension funds instead of putting those money into the classrooms.
Now, the thing about a budget, and I'm sure you know this, Suleiman, is that it gets pulled in all kinds of different directions. A lot of important things to spend in this state, wildfire prevention. Yeah, sure. Clean water, affordable housing, the homeless. Sure. What's your sense from talking with your colleagues about more funding for K-12 education? Will it be a priority this legislative session?
You know, really, you know, it's a fair question. I think everything's a priority. You know, when I go around the state, when I talk in my district.
We just had a strike here in L.A. That's why I think people in L.A. want to know
about
that.
You know, everything's a priority. If you talk to people in Tulare, drinking water's a priority. There's almost a million people in California today who don't have drinking water. So, again, we have many priorities. All these things are important. We have a broad coalition of support looking for single-payer and universal health care. That's a priority. So these are all very important things that we're trying to balance every day in a budget. Again, K-12 will be getting an increase this year, just like years past. The proposal is to go from overall about $77 billion to $80 billion, so it's a $3 billion increase.
But Suleiman, you can understand how parents and teachers in L.A. are looking to you in the state capitol to say, okay, look,
agreed. Agreed. And I think I've been talking about reform of Prop 13. They can take hands into their own matter when Prop 13 reform gets on the ballot in 2020, when they have revenue measures to raise more revenue for schools, for the state. They can take hands, you know, they can take their own responsibility into their own hands right now. So that's really what we're encouraging people to do. The budget, we can only spend the money that people have agreed to send us. If people want more money for schools, and I completely agree, I have young children in public schools right now as well, we need to raise more revenue.
When do you expect lawmakers to really dig into these budget proposals?
We are starting to dig in now, and we hold budget hearings from the end of February all the way to mid-May. And every one of those hearings is public testimony, and we will get a significant amount of input from people all over the state. And just so you're aware, education, K-12 education, by far gets the largest percentage of the state budget, 40% of the general fund. The next closest item is higher education at about 12%.
Is there anything, though, you're waiting for to declare education spending a priority? Anything in particular? Anything
education
that we can
look? Is our number one priority.
Number one, okay.
We spend by far. Perhaps you just didn't just hear me. It's 40% of our general fund is K through 12 education. The next item is 12%. So far and away, K through 12 education is by far the most amount of money that we spend.
Assemblymember Phil Ting, chair of the California Assembly Budget Committee, talking about the future of education spending. Assemblymember, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, moving on.
I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
Senator Kamala Harris officially launched her presidential bid at a rally in Oakland on Sunday. Harris is now part of what's likely to be a crowded Democratic field. But early fundraising milestones seem to place the senator in a top tier. So what does the road ahead look like for Kamala Harris? Carla Marinucci is senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Welcome back, Carla.
Yeah, good to be with you, A.
All right. That fundraising milestone, by the way, her campaign says she raised about $1.5 million 24 hours after she first announced her run last week. Overall, how has Senator Harris been received since the announcement?
Well, there's no question that the political establishment on both sides of the aisle really set up and took notice big time with Kamala Harris's events this week. She managed a very savvy campaign rollout, in effect nabbing two major days of news headlines on Martin Luther King Day when she announced on Good Morning America. And she raked in that haul of $1.5 million from all 50 states, as you mentioned. And then yesterday was that big event in Oakland. I was there, and I got to tell you, I've seen a lot of these rollouts, but this one turned out to be a picture-perfect example of a presidential campaign launch. Her campaign has got to be happy about it. 20,000 people showing up on a beautiful day, this adoring crowd, and a very strong speech from her that sort of laid out this rationale to run, introducing herself as Kamala Harris for the people. A very smart use of the same phrase that a prosecutor uses in the courtroom. And then she hit on all the major touchstones, you know, that are going to appeal to progressive voters, Medicare for all, and climate change and immigration reform. But she I think the main message is she offered herself as an anecdote to Donald Trump with truth and civility. And I think that's what her campaign says is going to be the main appeal, the main message going forward, that she can help heal this divide and get the country moving again in Washington. So she accomplished all of those things yesterday. I think a lot of people would say that it was really kind of a grand slam for her.
Now, an LA Times headline on Sunday said Harris has emerged as a 2020 front runner. I'm wondering, Carla, is it too early to make that kind of call for any candidate, much less Kamala Harris?
Yeah, it's too early, but she is definitely in the top tier after yesterday. I mean, by the time it was over, she had gotten the attention of every major news outlet in the country. And, you know, some of the analysts out there who really do deep dives into this, like Nate Silver at 538.com, say she is now particularly well positioned to attract some of the key constituencies that is going to be crucial to the next Democratic nominee, like the left, the party loyalists, African-American voters, millennials. And yeah, so she's on top of the mountain today, but you know that may be only a glimmer of what comes next. Because look, what I call the five B's are still out there who have to make a decision. That would be Biden, Bernie, Bloomberg, Booker, and Beto. And when they get in, then we'll see how it all shakes out.
The five B's. You might have to put that on a T-shirt or something, Carla.
Yeah,
make some money off of that. Yeah. Now, okay. Now, given, of course, the state of the Democratic Party, even a whisper that someone might be a frontrunner could make them a bigger political target. I have a big old bullseye on them. Why is that?
That's right. Well, you know, because being a front runner is tough work. You are in the bullseye for not only every other candidate.
That's been me my whole career, Carla.
That's right. That's right. And you're a bullseye for the guy in the White House who's very good at targeting people and giving them nicknames. He hasn't done that yet to Kamala Harris. But, you know, the Republican Party immediately took off after her yesterday as being too radical and too liberal. And in her own party, she'll be called, you know, the establishment. Everything she says will be put under a microscope. But the big problem is that once you race out of the gate, you got to keep your foot on the gas. And that means fundraising. And that means maintaining momentum, because every little fall, people will be looking at that as a failure. I think, you know, most people who saw her on Sunday agreed, you know, she had this incredibly strong start. But to stay ahead of the pack now, that is a very big lift, and she's got a big challenge ahead of her in doing that.
All right, now Senator Harris is unique in that she comes from California just after the state moved up its 2020 primary date to March. She's recognized here, which could give her an edge against outsiders, and there's some thought that California could set the tone for this race. But on Friday, Harris was in South Carolina, going to vote in February. Carla, how important are states such as South Carolina and Iowa to Harris?
Yeah, I mean, South Carolina is very important. I mean, Iowa, of course, is the first in the nation caucus, so that's always been the first traditional stop. And she's there tonight, by the way, doing a CNN town hall at 10 p.m. Pacific. But Harris's South Carolina strategy is a really smart one, because she's aiming there and in other southern states, too, particularly to reach women of color. And that would be African-American women. They are some of the most reliable voters in the country. And we're watching Harris make some moves like, you know, embracing her connection with those historically black colleges like Howard University, her own alma mater. And she's really pumping up her membership in the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. That is the largest and oldest African-American women's sorority in the country. That's 300,000 women. So in states like South Carolina, this is really going to matter. It is a state that has a very large African-American population. So when you go into those early states, that's exactly what her campaign is looking at, going to those early states. South Carolina is after Nevada, which also is an important state for Kamala Harris, that borders on California. A lot of people are familiar with her there. So when you get to those early contests, then you come to California and nine primaries and caucuses on March 3rd. That's Harris's home state, and, you know, she has a very good shot at being the favorite daughter by that time.
Carla Marinucci.
There's a lot of strategy going on there.
Sorry, Carla. Carla Marinucci is senior editor for Politico's California Play. We got to start printing those T-shirts and caps with the killer bees thing, Carla. Carla, thanks a lot for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, if you look at three major film awards and do some gender math, the answer may or may not surprise you. Directors Guild of America, Academy Awards, Golden Globes combined nominated seven people for Best Director of a Feature Film. Not a single one of those directors is a woman. But there is a category where women in the chair are getting some recognition. Find out what it is and why it's important when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. The Sundance Film Festival is in full swing. Now in its 34th year, the annual Park City event is known for shining a spotlight on small, independent projects. The Frame's John Horn is at Sundance, and he's on the line to catch us up on what he's seen, what's been sold, and who he's talked to. Hello, John.
Hey, A, how's it going?
Good, good. All right. Sundance started Thursday night, runs through Sunday. How's it been going so far?
We have been keeping very busy at the Frame. It's myself, my producers, Monica Bushman, my editor, Darby Maloney. I made a tally this morning. We have seen most of 33 movies so far, so we're keeping very busy. No one yet has gone down for the count. A lot of people we've interviewed have fallen on the icy roads around here, but so far we're still intact, both in mind and in spirit.
In addition to being a film festival, Sundance is also a film market where movies looking for distribution try to find a buyer. And sounds like we've been getting a lot of activity in the last 3 days, right?
I would say insane activity. So the previous sales record for a movie that premiered at Sundance was set a couple years ago when Netflix bought the movie Mudbound for $12.5 million. Now, there's one deal that is apparently in the works and might close soon. And if that closes, there will be three deals that have exceeded that record price in the last couple of days. New Line and Warner Brothers are apparently about to close a deal for $15 million for a movie called Beyond the Light. It's a film about a young man growing up in Britain in the late 80s. He's a Muslim teen, and he finds direction in his life through the music of Bruce Springsteen. There's a movie called The Report, which is about the Senate Intelligence Committee report about U.S. sanctioned torture of detainees post 9/11. Amazon bought that for reported $14 million. And then there's a movie called Late Night about a late night talk show host that Amazon also bought for about $13 million.
Now, okay, so you mentioned how, okay, Amazon is bidding for two of these movies. For them, is it about just that it's a great movie that they want to kind of attach their name to? Because we don't know necessarily how much money it's going to make them.
Yeah, it's a slightly different model than Netflix. So Amazon traditionally takes its movies and puts them in theaters for a couple of months before it puts them on Amazon Prime. So unlike Netflix, where you might have a movie like Roma that has played in some theaters, you don't really know what kind of box office it's done. Amazon has a different model where they will actually put films in theaters. You know what the box office is, and then they'll put them on their streaming platform. And their model is built on the word of mouth that they're going to get through that theatrical run. So we do know kind of how they do in theaters, but like Netflix, we don't know how well they do once they hit the streaming site. But it is appealing to theater owners because they won't book Netflix movies because they release them on Netflix the same time they put them in theaters, whereas Amazon kind of follows the old studio model of distributing films in theaters first and then putting them out on streaming services later.
Talking to John Horn of The Frame. He's at the Sundance Film Festival now. John, you talked to the directors of some of those movies. Who made Late Night and what's it all about?
The director's name is Misha Ganatra. This is a story that is semi-autobiographical for Mindy Kaling, who wrote, produced, and co-stars in the film. Mindy Kaling plays a writer on a late-night talk show that is hosted by Emma Thompson. So already we have a little bit of fiction. We have a network talk show that's hosted by a woman because we know that doesn't happen.
Oh.
But Misha Ganatra has a lot in common with Mindy Kaling, who is the star of the film. And we talked to Misha about where their stories overlap. And here's what she said.
It was a very personal story to her. You know, she was the diversity hire on The Office, this had come The Office, and she was the only woman in the writer's room. And even though she says she had very positive experiences, you know, it still is something to be the only anything in a room. And that happens to me all the time as well. So when I read this script, I thought, oh my God, this is my experience as well. I'm this character, Molly. And she sort of said, no, I'm Molly. And then we were like, okay, well, we're Molly. So let's figure out how we can tell this story together.
And I think one of the things that's notable, too, is Misha Ganatra is obviously a woman. And unlike other festivals and unlike Hollywood itself, there are a lot of women who are making movies up in Sundance. More than half the films in the dramatic competition here are directed by women. So Sundance is certainly a leader in that category as it stands.
Well, let's talk about one more. You spoke with Lulu Wong, who wrote and directed The Farewell. Tell us more about that film.
This is a fictionalized version of a true story of what happened to Lulu Wong. She is a Chinese American woman, and at a certain point, her grandmother became ill. And as is the tradition in some Chinese families, no one told the grandmother that she was actually terminally ill. They didn't want to upset her. So they organized a wedding, which may have been a sham, so that everybody could go to China and visit the grandmother before she passed away. And it's a very sweet movie. Awkwafina plays essentially Lulu's character in the film. It's very sweet. It was a very difficult movie for Lulu to get made. It actually was originally an episode on This American Life. And then from that show, it ended up becoming a movie, which is further proof that going on public radio can mean great things if you have a great story to tell.
Now, Sundance has become famous for a lot of documentaries that premiere at the festival, and Sundance documentaries often go on to the Oscars. What documentaries this year are getting a lot of attention?
There's been so many great documentaries that we've seen. Just on a short list, I'd put Hail Satan, which is a movie not so much about Satanism, but about religious tolerance and, I guess, intolerance in the United States. Alex Gibney, who's a well-known documentary filmmaker, made a movie about Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes, the kind of blood testing scam. It's called The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley. David Crosby of CSN and CSNY has made a documentary called David Crosby, Remember My Name. And then last night, and you'll hear more about this on The Frame later today, there's a documentary called Knock Down the House about four women running for Congress in the United States. One of those four women, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who I think we know becomes the youngest woman ever elected to Congress.
Now, John, the first day of the festival, a documentary called Leaving Neverland about Michael Jackson really caused a lot of controversy. What's the reaction been over the weekend over that?
When the festival decided they were going to show the film, they were immediately threatened with a lot of potential violence. There was high security when the film was screened Friday morning. It's a movie that documents the allegations of two young boys, now adults, about how they say they were sexually assaulted by Michael Jackson. And the people who've seen it, including Frame editor Darby Maloney, say that it's very persuasive. And today the Jackson family came out with a statement trying to discredit the film. It's been a movie that a lot of people have talked about. I think people whose minds are never going to be changed, are not going to be changed by this film. But a lot of people that I talked to who saw the movie said it was really compelling proof that Michael Jackson had sexually assaulted these young boys, even though, as we should note, he has never been convicted of any such charge.
John Horn is the host of The Frame. That's KPCC's arts and entertainment program today at 3:30. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks, hey.
As we just heard, about half of the directors in the drama category at this year's Sundance Film Festival are women. And I'm sure a lot of you out there are thinking, well, it's about time. Getting more women in the director's chair has been a long time coming, and part of the reason it's happening is short films, which are an important stepping stone into bigger projects. Take-Two's Emily Henderson attended a recent event at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood that celebrates short films directed by women, and she brings us a story.
There's a reason the audience at the Focus on Female Directors screening was so enthusiastic. The films being shown on the big screen at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood focused on topics that ranged from aging with sex appeal to Asian cuisines to a Janelle Monáe music video, reflecting the diversity of the women that created them.
It's not just white women, it's women of, you know, many cultures and many races and different countries, but also in the genre. So we see everything from animation to documentary to action films.
That's Andrew Crane, co-founder of the annual event put on by the American Cinematheque, now in its 14th year. The inspiration for the series, he said, was the lack of women in the director's chair.
So it just felt as though there was a need for it, and there was a niche there. And while there's many more female directors today, there's still, you know, there's no parity with men.
One way to fix that, says Kim Edelman, a film producer who also co-founded the Focus on Female Directors series, is to look at the short format.
This is the beautiful thing about short films and why I am always so in love with them. There's no barrier to entry. So unlike features, where there's always dismal numbers about how many women are allowed to direct studio features, short film, you can decide you want to make a film tomorrow and you can make it.
And often, shorts are a stepping stone to those bigger movie deals. Take the Pixar short Bao. The director, Domi Shi, is now working on a feature film for the animation powerhouse. Bao tells the story of a Chinese woman who makes a dumpling that comes to life. The story is also a metaphor of sorts for parenthood and having to let your children grow up.
I just really wanted Bao to be just a celebration of all of these things that were really important to me and that I really love, like Chinese food, like the Chinese immigrant community.
Shi, who is Chinese-Canadian, said these were things that she didn't see much on the big screen, and she wanted to change that.
It's really cool to see how people interpret the short and what they take away from it. Like, a lot of people would be like, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe you depicted an interracial, like, couple. That's so cool.
She is also the first woman to direct a short for Pixar.
I feel incredibly honored and really humbled, but also I'm like, what, really? About time.
Susan Bay Nimoy is another director who broke barriers when she helped found the Directors Guild of America's Women's Steering Committee. Her new project is a short film called Eve. It started out as a personal project for Nimoy to process her grief over the death of her husband, actor Leonard Nimoy. But it grew into something bigger. The 75-year-old stars in the short, in addition to directing it, and wanted the main character, Eve, to portray older women in a way that wasn't so stereotypical.
Because we don't see sexy or vibrant or strong women of age very often in storytelling on the screen.
Eve screened at Sundance this year, and now Nimoy is working with the prestigious film festival to fund fellowships for women directors. She's also working on turning her short into a full-length movie.
And I want women on the crew. I want women to be more prevalent in the industry and not be sort of a statistic.
Film producer Kim Adelman says this all comes down to changing the stories we see in film.
Movies are so important in our society, and they put images in our head and they tell us stories. And if it's only a certain type of person, like a white male who gets to be in charge of that and do that, then we're only hearing certain kinds of stories.
And that's really what the Focus on Female Directors screening is all about, encouraging women to get out there, grab a camera, and tell their own stories. For Take Two, I'm Emily Henderson.
All right, President Trump made lots of claims last week when he made his case for why the U.S. needs a wall at the southern border. And one of the reasons he says it's necessary is to stop the flow of drugs into the country. And it got us wondering exactly what kinds of drugs are getting through and how. Find out from someone that's been inside a drug tunnel when under the border when Take Two continues.
KVCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. President Trump last Friday again laid out his arguments for more physical barriers along the southern border.
Barriers, fencing, or walls, or whatever you want to call it.
And one of those arguments?
Vast quantities of lethal drugs, including meth, fentanyl, heroin, and cocaine, are smuggled across our southern border.
Okay, so to get a better sense of how drugs are coming into the United States, we turn to KPCC's immigration reporter, Leslie Berstein Rojas. Hello, Leslie.
Hi, eh?
All right, what quantities of illegal narcotics are smuggled over the borders each year?
Well, the numbers from last year aren't broken down as well as we'd like, but overall in fiscal year 2018, U.S. Customs and Border Protection intercepted close to 900,000 pounds of illegal drugs at ports of entry. And these are incomplete numbers, by the way, because the agency still hasn't added the last month of the fiscal year, which was September, but it gives you a pretty good idea. This includes all ports of entry, by the way, not just land ports, but airports, seaports, in between border ports of entry, and at Border Patrol checkpoints on the U.S. side, you know, like the one in San Clemente off of I-5. Yeah. And we're talking northern and southern borders, of course.
What kinds of drugs are we talking about?
You know, these tallies from CBP include cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, marijuana, and also fentanyl, which they've been tracking more closely over the last couple of years.
Now, we spoke to Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff on Friday. That was after President Trump's speech. And here's what he had to say about how drugs are smuggled into the country.
We know that drug smuggling across the border, the vast majority of that does not happen between ports of entry. They're trucked in or boated in, and they often come through the ports themselves.
So he's saying that drugs mostly come through legal points of entry. Leslie, what do we know about that?
Well, by and large, what he's saying is correct, yes. I mean, what's referred to as dangerous drugs, heroin, cocaine, meth, fentanyl, the vast, vast majority of these do come through the ports of entry. I'll give you some examples. deals in fiscal year 2018 through the end of August, more than 9 times as much heroin came through ports of entry like San Ysidro or Otay Mesa than was intercepted at Border Patrol checkpoints or elsewhere along the border. More than 7 times as much cocaine came through legal ports of entry. More than 6 times as much meth came through legal ports of entry. More than 4 times as much fentanyl. Wow. Yes. Now, these drugs are typically hidden not just in passenger cars and vans, but also in tractor trailers mixed in with legitimate goods. I mean, this is how these drugs typically get across. And by the way, let's not forget that a lot of drugs are intercepted at sea. In fiscal year 2017, the U.S. Coast Guard intercepted more than 450,000 pounds of cocaine, for example. So there's also that. Now, Customs and Border Protection says the only drug that does tend to be found more by the Border Patrol than at ports of entry is pot. You saw about 1.5 times more illegal marijuana intercepted by the Border Patrol at checkpoints and in between ports of entry. Now, this will include shipments, say, in a vehicle that may have come through a port of entry but did not get found out. And agents will find it at one of their checkpoints in the interior. There are at least 100 of these, by the way, mostly in the Southwest, but also in northern states.
Leslie, has this increased in recent years?
Well, just looking at Customs and Border Protection numbers over the past few years, since 2015, say, you're seeing an overall decrease in drug seizures overall by border officials. Now, specific drugs, that varies. For example, in the past year, you've seen more meth at ports of entry. But the overall numbers are down, and I should mention that marijuana seizures especially are way down over the past 2 or 3 years.
All right. The big thing everyone's arguing about, to both sides, any evidence that more physical barriers along the border would prevent those drugs from coming through?
Well, you know, many experts say that because of the ways in which drugs move into the country, a physical barrier like a wall would not be the most effective thing. I mean, the border between Tijuana and San Diego, it's already heavily fortified. There's double fencing, triple fencing in some parts. And yet, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration said in a report last year that most of the heroin seized by Customs and Border Enforcement occurs in the San Diego area, and that the bulk of it comes through the legal ports of entry. By the way, I should mention that there have also been many drug tunnels found relatively often in the San Diego area over the years. I've been in a couple of them.
Oh, wow.
And these go right under the border fence.
That's KPCC's Leslie Berstein-Rojas with the latest on how drugs are typically smuggled into the United States. Leslie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Staying with issues of immigration, more than 4 in 10 refugees and asylum seekers living in the United States experience torture in their home countries. As the Trump administration looks to restrict asylum cases, there's one program in Los Angeles working to help migrants deal with the effects of torture as they seek permission to stay in the U.S. KPCC's Aaron Schrank reports.
It's a typically busy day in the Koreatown office of the Program for Torture Victims. Therapist Rosemarie Durocher says she's been with clients all morning.
A young woman from Uganda who suffered from female genital mutilation. And then I had another client who's lesbian from Armenia. Another one from Russia who has suffered persecution because they're protesting against the government.
When this program was created 4 decades ago by a pair of South American refugees, it was the only one in the country providing rehabilitation to victims of state-sponsored torture. There are now about 60. Durocher says most of the hundreds who walk through their doors each year suffer from post-traumatic stress.
And if you've had to leave your country for fighting for human rights or religious rights, those things are very traumatic.
Her office provides medical care, case management, trauma therapy, and forensic evaluations. 90% of asylum seekers who get these exams are granted asylum, compared to 43% overall.
If they've had a psychological assessment, it is a big support to their case.
1/4 of their clients are LGBT. About 8% fled religious persecution, like Christian pastor Wenkon Chin. When I met Chin at a small church in Orange County's Little Saigon, the exiled evangelical still had a scar on his head from one of many beatings by Vietnamese authorities.
Between 1990 and 2011, I was interrogated more than 400 times. And each time that I was interrogated, I was also tortured.
Through an interpreter, Pastor Chin says he was interrogated for preaching to and advocating for Protestant ethnic groups not approved by the communist government, like the Montagnards in the Central Highlands.
They start to attack the local congregations that have anything to do with me. Some of the pastor and congregation member were tortured and killed.
In 2011, Vietnam charged Chin with undermining national unity and sentenced him to 11 years in prison, where he spent time in solitary confinement and was fed shards of glass. Behind bars, Chin organized hunger strikes with other prisoners of conscience over their mistreatment. Then, halfway through his sentence, Chin was released on the condition that he left Vietnam with his family right away.
I picked Santa Ana because this is the capital of free Vietnamese. I wanted to come here because of the community here, but also to settle down and sought treatment for whatever condition I had.
Clinical director Carol Gomez says it's the job of the program for torture victims to help asylum seekers like Chin put the pieces together after a disorienting journey.
Almost like a Star Trek episode. You kind of beam yourself over to another country and then all the molecules settle, but then you're in another country and you're like, what the heck? I don't even know how this place works.
Gomez says most of her clients arrive with optimism that America will be a land of the free that respects their human rights.
The reality, especially if they're coming in more recent times, has certainly been a lot more shocking. Many people find themselves detained for weeks or months in shackles and in orange jumpsuits.
Those waiting to be granted asylum can't get work authorization to bring home a paycheck. Therapist Rosemarie Durocher says the transition is especially hard for victims of torture.
They've lost so much, and if we don't have a program to help them, they go on with depression, they flounder around for a long time. They need something to get on their feet again.
But LA's program for torture victims can only serve about 300 people each year. That's just a drop in the bucket of more than a million refugee and asylum seekers, survivors of torture living across the country. Covering religion and diaspora, I'm Aaron Schrank.
All right, whether you love them or hate them, it seems like e-scooters are in LA to stay. They can be a little bare, though, in the protection department. Now we're getting data on what kinds of injuries people are getting. Find out in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
You can maximize your impact on KPCC in one easy step. Simply switch your sustaining membership so it comes directly from your bank account. Although credit cards are great, they actually cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in fees. Switching to your bank account will help us save about $300,000 a year, which we can then spend on the programming you love. It only takes a minute to make the switch. Go to kpcc.org/switch. Thanks.
Back now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Electric scooters from the likes of Lime and Bird have exploded in popularity over the past year, but their safety record has been a little thin. At least it has until now. The Journal of the American Medical Association has crunched the data for a year's worth of emergency room visits to two Los Angeles hospitals and has started to put a finer point on what types of injuries scooter riders are getting and why. Tariq Dravidi is one of the report's researchers. He's also a scooter rider and a doctor with the Veterans Administration of Greater LA. Welcome to Take Two.
Hello.
Hi, Doctor. Now, okay, your research is based on data that was collected at two emergency rooms in West LA and Santa Monica, which is where electric scooters were first introduced. How did you figure out that these emergency room visits were specifically because of scooters?
Sure. So we actually went through the electronic health records. We did an automated search through all of the text in emergency department provider notes for physician notes and nursing notes. So we looked for words like scooter or Lime or Bird. And then the total number of encounters that had some variation of those words was about 523, exactly 523. And so we then went through all of those manually and parsed it down to about 249 that had that were actually freestanding electric scooter related injuries. So, you know, we had a certain criteria where the word electric scooter had to be mentioned, or it had to be a Bird scooter or a Lime scooter that was mentioned, and it had to be you know, in the context of an injury associated with someone riding.
Well, doctor, then what sorts of injuries are people getting that land them in the ER?
So, you know, one out of three patients who came to the ER had fractures. Another 40% actually had some sort of minor head injury, and five of whom actually had intracranial hemorrhage, which is bleeding within the skull, you know, in between the skull and the brain. So serious bleeding. And then we had lots of patients with cuts, scrapes, and bruises, severe enough to land them in the ER, you know, whether they required stitches or suturing. There were a number of injuries like that. So the fractures themselves, you know, they range all the way from, you know, ankle and wrist fractures, forearm fractures, to even one patient who had a cervical spinal fracture, which is a neck fracture that, you know, can put the spinal cord in jeopardy.
Can I kind of assume that it's because people are just falling off these things?
That was what, you know, we were reviewing emergency department encounter notes. So, you know, from our end as clinicians, we're documenting more about the patient's status rather than about than specifics about the accident that happened. Although we do, you know, there is information that's valuable in there. So we found that, you know, 8 or 9% of the riders who came in had been hit by moving vehicles, mostly cars. But 80% of the visits, we weren't able to give you a specific reason. We know that they fell off the scooter somehow. We knew that in a number of other cases that the clinician documented the patient crashed into something. So there's a wide range of mechanisms, but for the most part, we're not 100% sure if these are just people falling off due to inexperience, whether it's due to equipment failure. Anecdotally, people have described, you know, when the brakes sort of stick on some of the older scooters that, you know, haven't had that need upkeep.
We're talking to Dr. Tarek Trivedi, one of the report's researchers about scooter injuries. Helmets, Dr. Helmets. What role does helmets play in whether or not a scooter rider who loses control gets injured? Because I know there's a new law that just took effect in California that says adults over the age of 18 don't need to wear a helmet when they ride a scooter.
That's correct. Helmets are incredibly important. You know, like I said, there were five patients who had intracranial hemorrhage. Yeah. Now, can I say for sure would we have prevented that with helmets? I'm not sure, but we know that helmets do work. There's plenty of evidence and data behind, you know, if you take a fall, if you experience head trauma, you want to be wearing a helmet. I'm a scooter rider myself, and I don't leave the home without a helmet. I sort of hook it onto my bag, and it's part of me. It's with me during the day because, you know, I don't know when I'm going to get onto these scooters or other micromobility options. Helmets are of utmost importance, and I wish there were a way to make them more convenient for people to use. I think the what happened with the law being passed is sort of unfortunate because we want to promote and encourage helmet use, and we want to create a culture of helmet use.
And you noticed, you actually kind of did a public observation part of this study where you noticed people just aren't wearing helmets.
Ask anyone who lives in West LA or Santa Monica. When you have, you know, when you're in these areas, you see that the culture is there is no helmet use. We were out this weekend walking around in Santa Monica, and just I observed hundreds more riders, just myself, while, you know, hanging out. No one's wearing a helmet. And we actually did a scientific kind of approach to this. We put our people on three different corners, three separate occasions, a total of 7 hours on weekdays and weekends, and just counted people as they rode by us. And we found 94% were not wearing helmets. So we had, you know, a total of 6% of riders that had a helmet on. So it's not part of the culture right now. And given the number of significant injuries, the fractures, the head injuries, the intracranial hemorrhages, I think that there is a huge need right now for people to understand the importance and for sort of a company or an innovator to come in and figure out a way to make helmets more convenient.
Now, Doctor, one of the headlines that's come out of your research is that it's more dangerous to ride a scooter than to walk or ride a bicycle. Is that fair to scooters?
That's not a fair comparison. I think that we don't have a denominator. In epidemiology, we talk about denominators because we need to know the total amount of exposure that people had. And we don't have the number of miles of bicycles completed or the electric scooters completed in our area. You know, for example, if the scooter rides amounted to, you know, several million miles more than bicycle rides, then our numbers have to be taken into that context. You know, we did see 249 scooter injuries over the course of this year. And we did, in a post hoc analysis suggested by a reviewer, they asked it sort of contextually, they wanted to know the number of bicycle accidents, and we had 191. But I don't think that's a fair comparison because we don't know the number of miles. We don't really know out of how much exposure, what the real risk is. So I think that's an important next step. And if anyone continues this research on, that's kind of what everyone wants to know, is how dangerous are these new forms of micromobility transportation compared to existing ones.
That's Dr. Tarek Trivedi, one of the researchers on a new scooter safety study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Doctor, thanks a lot for the time.
Thank you.
As I mentioned earlier, L.A. is gearing up for the Super Bowl next weekend. The Rams taking on the Patriots. Fans were in Inglewood yesterday for a send-off for the Rams. It was actually pretty wild out there. Now, bars like Block Party in Highland Park and Brack Shop Tavern downtown will have watch parties for the big game. Local landmark Randy's Donuts even has a new coat of paint. It's decked out in Rams blue and yellow. But we want to hear how you're cheering on the Rams this week and what it means to you that L.A. is going to the Super Bowl. Tweet us at Take Two or find us on Facebook. We're at Take Two Show. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, A Martinez LA. That's A Martinez LA. The Frame with John Horn coming up at 3:30 from Sundance. Talk to you guys tomorrow, too.